But without further ado, I want to turn my attention now to, or turn your attention rather, to our next speaker, Adam Marie Summerson. Adam works for Clark Energy, and he's going to give us an insight now into some of the enabling mechanisms that might lie behind net zero. Adam, over to you.
And apologies, guys, I tore my hamstring last night, so I am hobbling and I'm in a lot of pain. And unfortunately, Jonathan, I'm going to continue to talk a little bit about politics, given the title of the presentation that was given to me. So I'm Adam Ray Summerson, Head of Sustainable Solutions for Clark Energy. We are a global energy solutions business whose name was made really in the gas engine sector, primarily operating in combined heat and power applications, landfill gas applications, renewable and non-renewable gas engine applications, maybe in the kind of 10 to 50 megawatts historically. Through the kind of ongoing decarbonisation of our sector, through kind of the interests of our business growing and developing, there's recognition really that we need to diversify to remain at the forefront of the energy industry. And subsequently, in the last couple of years, we've started really looking at battery energy storage, heat pump technologies, electrolytic hydrogen, carbon capture, utilization rather than the storage side, importantly for us at least, and various other technologies, really appreciating that irrespective of the prime mover, the civils infrastructure, the mechanical electrical infrastructure around a delivery of a project often remains the same, but then the ongoing maintenance and service of those assets and looking after this equipment long into the future is kind of fundamental. So that's kind of who we are. So initially then, looking at kind of the policy, you may or may not disagree with me, but at the moment, given that we are entering real general election fever, energy policy is something of a car crash. There's a lot of interesting rhetoric out there. There's been a lot of good work done over the last couple of years and over the last decade, absolutely, and prior to that. But there is also a lot of uncertainty, and I think when I talk about finance in a couple of moments, that will become prevalent. So far, the Conservatives have issued their manifesto, pretty light on the detail with regards to energy. The Lib Dems have pledged to bring the net zero target forward from 2050, and we await manifestos, I think, tomorrow from Labour and later in the week, potentially from the Greens, SNP, and anyone else who I suspect will do somewhat less favourably in the election. But nevertheless, let's look at what we've done and where we have come, particularly in the energy sector and actually in the electricity system. We've done a tremendously good job of decarbonising electricity where it's been easy to do. We've implemented, and the government have helped support, the deployment of onshore wind, offshore wind, solar PV, and we've done a really good job to help decarbonisation within electricity. However, there's still quite a long way to go. And the problem's kind of worsened by virtue of the fact that as we look to electrify heat where we can, as we look to move to electric vehicles, system demand continues to grow. And if you look at National Grid's future energy scenarios, it's anticipated that peak demand's going to grow from around 50 gigawatts today to around 100 gigawatts. So we're demanding more, we've got to use less to satisfy that demand, and we have to do it also whilst continuing to try and reduce carbon emissions. So there is quite a challenge. And as you can see, even in National Grid's kind of future scenarios, they anticipate that there's still going to be a demand for mains gas on the system. Now, what that mains gas, what each molecule comprises, is likely to be very different to what it is today. There'll still be some methane there, but likely coming from biomethane sources. But there'll also be hydrogen, and there'll be other things kind of accompanying that. But further to that, you've also got a need right now to transform our electricity networks. I mean, since privatisation, the transmission and distribution systems haven't really advanced, haven't modernised as much as perhaps they could have done. And consequently, we have a situation where the vast majority of demand in this collection of nations is in the south and in the east. But the vast majority of renewable generation is actually in the north. So getting that supply to those demand centres is very, very important in any kind of policy infrastructure. And understanding, do I transport or store an electron, or do I transport or store a molecule, and understanding the differences and the benefits and the cohesion of the need to do both is critically important in that. I mean, if we look at what's happening in Scotland right now, last year, Scottish wind farm operators were paid £800 million to not generate renewable electricity through curtailment. I mean, it's astonishing when you think that's taxpayer money just thrown away effectively to not do the renewable thing that we need to do to ensure net zero. So what can we actually do to improve the situation, to maximise use of those renewables, particularly when they are intermittent, and through storage, through electrolytic production of hydrogen, we've got means to kind of help balance the system longer term. And in balancing the system, it kind of ensures and reinforces what National Grid are telling us, in that gas is really a path and a useful path on that trip to net zero. So understanding how we get there is important, understanding the importance. In each individual half hour of the day, do I use that electron of renewable power now? Do I store it, or do I produce a molecule of hydrogen from it? How on, perhaps a little underwhelming in terms of the strike rate that was that was awarded, the number of projects that saw contracts awarded, and the fact now that we enter into election madness means that some of the Harwon successful projects haven't actually received their hydrogen contracts yet, and that's delaying projects actually happening. We're working on a couple of Harwon projects just now as Clark Energy, and the reality is production by March of 26, which is what Harwon is contracted to deliver, is likely to be delayed because of the fact that we're entering an election year. R2, I think, forecast to enable another 750 meg there or thereabouts. But right now, if you look at electrolytic hydrogen production in the UK, we've got 30 megawatts-ish under construction, 10 megawatts-ish operational, quite a lot in planning, quite a lot needed to achieve that 10 gigawatt target by 2030. I think the important thing to note there is that that 2030 target is a cross-party agreement and a target that both Labour and Conservatives and other parties have all kind of signed up to. So it should be safe irrespective of who comes into power in the next couple of months. We heard a couple of years ago from a previous Prime Minister that there is no magic money tree. You type finance into Google and actually one of the first things that come up is a magic money tree. So there we are. But in 2023, the Climate Change Committee and Office for Budget Responsibility both indicated that the majority of investment required to reach net zero will need to come from the private sector. We've seen with what was the renewable obligation certificate, then became the feed-in tariff, and alongside that, the renewable heat incentive, that government helps where it can to incentivise and to encourage investment in certain areas. But as deployment proceeds, as we start to see maturity in technology types, it then becomes important for the private sector to try and take the lead, really, in terms of those financial investment decisions. But it is tricky, and actually there is a fine balance, and we can see from Harwon, from the strike rate achieved, from various other green levies and incentives over the years, that if government take away the levy too soon, or if the levy's not attractive enough, that actually for private financiers to come in and look to invest their own money, and often pension money or banks' money, then the balance is very finely met. So government have looked to try and support the financial sector, looking at the transition pathway. The top right of that image does concern me a bit, government accountability. I think we can probably question the last few years how accountable government has been, but the reality is there needs to be this integration, this kind of working together between the private sector, between government, between industry, to ensure that actually we are helping investors become confident in that which we're asking them to do. Investor confidence is often damaged by political instability, contractors failing. In my industry, two of our competitors became insolvent last year because they made poor commercial contracting decisions cash went out of their respective businesses, they weren't able to deliver on their commercial obligations. That damages investor confidence and stifles kind of the private sector then in trying to do stuff. But nevertheless, that pathway, what we can do, where we can get to, I think personally is heavily dependent on what I like to call an integrated energy system. It's understanding and appreciating that we use the renewable resources when they are available, that we store electrons or molecules as appropriate when we can't use it, and then that we deploy the technologies as best we can, but also recognizing that there might need be times, even in 2050, where mains gas is providing some energy resilience solution to our system. So to achieve kind of the energy trilemma, as it is often posed, the sustainability, affordability, and reliability elements of our net zero future, we need to reduce our consumption, we need to improve our efficiencies, and we need to maximize use of renewable energy, which I think is key. And we can do that through a number of different applications. I'm going to fly through some certain things that highlight how different technologies work together to help achieve those end goals, as it were. So using battery energy storage, we can look at peak shifting, we can look at frequency regulation, we can also look at how we can restart national grid in the event of a catastrophic failure of the network. And we're delivering projects right now that help in that regard. Our first is Clark Energy Battery Energy Storage Project. It was a 20 megawatt 2-hour system with Field Energy in Newport, South Wales. That project is currently in construction, will be commissioned pretty soon actually. With regards electrolytic hydrogen and hydrogen production, or hydrogen use actually, you know, I'm here representing a company that the vast majority of the 8 gigawatts install base that we have is gas engines, but I'm about to say something that may surprise you. I don't want to see hydrogen necessarily in our gas engines, certainly not for baseload applications in the next 5 to 10 years, because the reality is that the harder to decarbonize, or the impossible to electrify heavy industry, transportation, logistics, aviation, those are the energy carriers that require that hydrogen to help them on their path to decarbonisation. And perhaps in the future, as electrolyzer technology and efficiencies improve, perhaps in the Dunkelflaute, apologies to any Germans in the room if my pronunciation is terrible there, but perhaps in that Dunkelflaute situation where we have the 2 weeks, 3 weeks in winter where renewables production is very, very low, all of the energy storage assets have kind of have expelled all of their stored capacity, in those circumstances, maybe then for that period of time, that's when you're fueling a gas engine or a gas turbine with hydrogen to provide that backup power solution. We are involved in, as I said, in a couple of HAR1 projects. This one in particular is a 7.5 megawatt green hydrogen production plant. We provided feed services to the client on that particular project, supported them through that hydrogen allocation round application process. They were successful. We await kind of EPC contracts and hope to enter into delivery of that project later this year. Then energy security, as I kind of come to the close, is an important thing to think about. We have a very well-established network infrastructure in this country. Gas pipelines, the electricity infrastructure. The image on the right is the transmission distribution gas pipe. We're a very, very well-connected system. The figures on the left relate to the German electricity and gas markets. And the numbers, which you may be able to make out, represent through overall periods throughout the last 15 years or so, downtime of the electricity system in Germany, on the left, 20-odd minutes, 15 minutes on average, and downtime of the gas system. Our gas infrastructure is very, very stable, and that's why it's important to acknowledge that energy resiliency comes from that gaseous form in the intermittent renewables future. And that's what we're seeing in data center applications. As data centers look to decarbonize their own kind of emissions, historically data centers all used diesel backups. They're moving now in the backup markets to gaseous fuels, but they're also looking to gaseous fueled systems for their baseload operations as well, in certain markets where grid connections might be difficult to ascertain because the grid is already constrained, or because renewable intermittency is causing network issues in that regard. Combining all of that with a CHP, with a heat pump, the integrated energy system, and managing each and every half hour is critical. So actually applying this to food and drink, applying this to horticulture, applying this to all kind of industries, we can look at how an integrated system offers benefits, which helps to reduce CO2 emissions compared to kind of conventional heating and electricity supply into our glass houses. And as the final kind of look, this is a project that produces renewable natural gas, or biomethane as we tend to call it over here, in Indiana, in North America. This was 100% privately invested project, helped, supported somewhat by US government energy policy. But this is a dairy farm with some 10,000 cattle. 25,000 cattle, there we go, producing 600,000 gallons of slurry on an annual basis. And that plant can produce around 1,000 standard cubic feet per minute, and we'll have to ask one of the oil and gas guys what that is in money that we understand in normal meters cubed per hour, of renewable natural gas, but then also 1.5 megawatt CHP system providing the heating and power demands of the dairy farm as well. We're here to help support your path to net zero. We want to help you in a variety of applications where we can, and look forward to further discussions with you. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. I'd now like to invite all of our panelists from this morning's sessions back on stage. So that's Duncan, Will, and Ian to join Adam on stage. And we're now going to have the opportunity for your questions.